Welcome to Small World, Big Problems, a podcast from the Philip Merrill Center for Strategic Studies at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies in Washington, D.C. My name is Eric Hsu, and today my guest is Dr. Oriana Schuyler Mastro. Dr. Mastro is a distinguished scholar, policy expert, and author whose work has shaped how we understand China's rise and its implications for global power dynamics. Dr. Mastro is a center fellow at the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies and currency assistant professor of political science at Stanford University. She's also a non-resident scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and recently published her book, Upstart, How China Became a Great Power. Dr. Mastro holds a bachelor's in East Asian Studies from Stanford and a master's and PhD in politics from Princeton. Dr. Mastro, thank you for coming on the podcast today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So we're recording this episode on January 20th. Donald Trump has just been sworn in as the 47th president. Do you think the new administration will shift its China policy or largely continue the previous administration's?
So I think it really depends on how you look at it. Most pundits would probably say it's going to be somewhat of a continuation of that competitive approach, with the United States being a little bit more protective on economic issues. You know, even the Biden administration had export controls and a degree of tariffs and continued strengthening of the military. But when it comes to the details, it's actually going to be quite different. I think that the fundamental theory of victory for President Trump and his administration is going to be to try to undermine the basis of Chinese power, which is different than what Biden was trying to do, which is build up U.S. power. And I think what that means is it's going to lead to different policies. And at least my view is a lot of the policies that the Trump administration are going to institute are going to be ineffective in terms of helping the balance of power in the U.S. favor and will exacerbate the tensions between China and the United States more.
And the one way to like better understand the policies is actually understand what China intends to do. And that was kind of one of your most recent books, Upstart, How China Became a Great Power. Kind of looked at that. So one thing within your book is you explored how China's rise to great power status has followed a unique trajectory, so diverging from the approaches of historical powers that directly challenge the status quo. What were those key differences in how China's strategy compared to those of past rising powers?
Well, to be clear, the book is not arguing maybe that China is unique compared to past rising powers, but that successful rising powers each pursue their own unique strategies. So what that means is that instead of emulating whatever the established great power is doing at the time, a successful great power does emulate it under certain conditions, but then also employ that same strategy as the established great power in new areas of competition. Sometimes I call that exploitation. And lastly, they do things that are completely new and innovative and different. And that is what I call the entrepreneurial approach. So in the book, I lay out 22 case studies, foreign policy, economics, military, the times they're emulating, the times they're exploiting, the times they're entrepreneurial. And it's really that mix of those three P's that make the Upstart approach. Now, the book is about China, so all the case studies are about China. But a cursory look would tell you that the United States did the exact same thing. Right, there are some aspects of U.S. power that were very entrepreneurial. Instead of having a colonial empire, the United States built international institutions, global military basing, instead of physically occupying other countries, pursuing, you know, free trade versus other forms of economic power. So it's not so much that this is a China-unique approach, but that there are incentives for rising powers to do things differently. And those incentives include, like, you know, during their rise, maybe what is effective is different. Right? The, you know, 1800s are different than 2025. It could also be, and this was a big factor for China, that they're trying to minimize the negative response of the established great power. So in the 90s and 2000s, one of the big considerations was how is the United States going to see this and respond to it? And just because you asked about President Trump, I would say one of the big differences between today and, you know, this the book maybe would argue what was going on 10 years ago, is that the Chinese have determined that the United States has decided that they are a threat. So they're no longer placing a premium on policies that reassure the United States. And they're no longer trying to avoid those that are overly threatening towards the United States. So they kind of feel like that ship has sailed. So in the conclusion of the book, I lay out, based on this argument, what aspects of Chinese policy we expect to change in the next, you know, 5 years, the future of Chinese strategy, and which ones are likely to stay the same. And so in the cases where they were just trying to be reassuring, like not building certain aspects of conventional military power, that's likely to change over the next 5 years. They're no longer concerned about how America feels about things.
One quote from your book I actually took was, "The rise of great power status requires a deliberate strategy to narrow their aspiring power's distance from the established great powers in terms of political, economic, and military power. Striving for mastery is a choice,
and not all rising powers make that choice. This has clearly not been the case for China. It has employed an upstart strategy over the past 30 years to enable its rise to great power status. In your view, is China's goal to replace the U.S. as a dominant global power, or more of China take the U.S. off its peg as the sole unit power and kind of make a multipolar world?
So part of the book is just also trying to challenge how we think about power. You know, one of the things, I've mentioned this before, that I worry about is that the United States is like a taxi company saying to Uber, well, we own more cars. It's like, okay, yes, that's true, but is that really the standard of, you know, success as a company now? And so whether or not they want to replace us, I mean, there's a lot of aspects where they don't want to replace the United States because they feel like U.S. strategy is ineffective, it's stupid, they don't want to be involved. So it's not the case when people make that argument about they want to replace the United States, that usually is assuming emulation. It's like they want to replace the United States by acting and looking exactly like the United States on the world stage. And so if that's the question, I think it's an easy no. They have a different idea of what, you know, global power looks like. So it's not for lack of ambition that I would answer that question no. It's just that they have a different vision of what that would look like. And so they don't need to, you know, be involved in every conflict around the world or be the head of every international organization the way the United States is to feel like they are a superpower.
What is that vision? Is it to go through international organizations such as the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, or kind of take what the old structure was, like the UN or the WTO, and kind of morph that under China's image?
So in that case, in that particular case, it's both. So they have an emulation strategy, which is gaining leadership positions within international institutions. They pursued that strategy because they recognized there was some institutional power there to be seized. And compared to other strategies, that tended to be more reassuring in the initial stages to the United States and allies and partners, because we had told China, if you participate actively in international institutions, we will be reassured. So they kind of felt like, you know, kill two birds with one stone type of situation. Same with building up their own institutions. I argue that it's predictable that the United States responded the way we did, because one of the problems with emulation is it tends to spark threat perceptions more than diverse strategies. And you can see this with the AIIB, for example, even though, you know, a lot of our allies and partners joined it because they assessed it was a good institution and China was acting according to international norms within that institution. The United States felt threatened because it looked exactly like how we exercise power. And so, you know, we refused to participate. So the contours of the upstart strategy do depend on a number of factors. One of them is, you know, how does China assess the effectiveness of U.S. strategy? And one is also kind of their competitive advantages. If they're going to be competing directly with the United States, where are they going to go wrong and when are they going to go right? Like when can they outcompete the United States? And if they can't, then they do something different. There's also this category, if emulating the United States undermines Communist Party control, that's also obviously not a strategy they're going to pursue. And therefore, that encourages more entrepreneurial approaches as well.
In your recent Foreign Affairs article, you noted that China has managed to carefully balance its relationship with U.S. adversaries like Iran, North Korea, and Russia without being blamed for outright supporting them. Is there anything that could move China toward outright support in the near future, or will they be able to continue walking this line?
So I think I can't imagine something that makes them move towards outright support because of the value of the alignment. There's nothing really those countries could give China that compels them to feel like that's in their best interest. I think that the more likely divergence would be to move away from those countries instead of sort of closer to them. I think they are as close as they would like to be right now. It's not China that wants to be closer to Russia and North Korea and those countries are uninterested. It's kind of the other way around. So the question is, what would convince China that those relationships are worth it? And as I mentioned in my article, I think part of it is if it comes at a cost towards their other relationships that they value. And this has happened a lot historically. It's you don't have to have it so that China believes Russia's a greater threat to them than the United States, right? That is not necessary for China to move away from Russia. They just have to have a difference of opinion with Russia about how to deal with the United States, even if they both find the United States threatening. And so we see a little bit of that. If it's the case that, you know, Russia's approach is very aggressive, a lot more aggressive than China wants, and that, you know, then backfires on China, they might think it's not worth being so close to that country.
Do you think the past few years have kind of forced China into reconsidering this position, either for or against being more aligned with these countries?
I don't think so. You know, my assessment is they haven't had to pay really any costs associated with these relationships. So, you know, you might as well continue to have your cake and eat it too.
One thing from like the U.S. perspective is this idea that allies are an important part of the alliance. And one thing that we're trying to do, or what the United States is looking at, is to deter China from taking Taiwan, for example, mm-hmm. and having allies and partners in the Indo-Pacific to help towards that cause. Are there any kind of countries, in your opinion, that have been successfully decoupling or de-risking from China, or kind of playing to that deterrent value that is in favor for the United States?
So it's all of this is a proportional, right? So it's hard to say if that threshold has been met. I think countries are starting to think more about the strategic costs of being so economically reliant on China. And that is influencing their decision making on a variety of issues. And I think that's the right direction to go in. But there's no situation under which you're not held at risk at all by China. So it really is kind of a hedging strategy. It doesn't make sense to completely decouple yourself from China, to like pay the economic costs you're afraid you'll have to pay just in case you'll have to pay them. Like, it does make sense to continue that relationship and hope for the best, but to be prepared for the worst. And so I think that, you know, all countries are doing that to varying degrees. I don't think we'll know really who did it best unless, you know, things really, conflict explodes or something, and then we see where the pieces lie.
And look at like more of the non-aligned countries, just the middle, low-income countries in Southeast Asia, Africa, South America. Do you foresee them continuing to stay non-aligned, and or does China want to start having more of these countries under their orbit?
So I don't really think this idea that they're non-aligned. So what China wants, and I have a section of this on the book, like what China wants is neutrality. So when countries choose neutrality, they are choosing China, because that is what the Chinese want from those countries. They want them to not support the United States, and they believe they get their strategic space from countries being relatively uninvolved on a number of issues. So especially in the region where that alignment requests for support are more military in orientation, it's very clear when a country says, no, United States, I'm not gonna support you militarily here. The U.S. requires other countries, you know, access, basing, overflight to be able to operate in Asia. China does not, because they're a resident there. So they don't need to ask for support the way the United States does. They just have to ask for neutrality. And it's the same thing kind of on the international stage, whether it's shaping norms and values. What they're asking from a lot of developing countries is just like, you know, don't support U.S. initiatives on certain things, which is a bit of an easier ask than, you know, support us. So I wouldn't necessarily, even the non-aligned countries, I was just in South Africa in November for a dialogue. I'm not an expert on South Africa, but based on the discussions we were having, I would not say that they are non-aligned. I would say that they lean very heavily towards China. Now, if it's about an official agreement, which those countries want to feel a degree of sovereignty, so they're like, we're not aligned because we are independent in our foreign policy, fine. But it's very clear that the China factor plays a very heavy role in their decision-making.
One piece of that is, you, in your Foreign Affairs article, you mentioned that the U.S. should not turn this conflict with China into a democracies versus autocracies contest. So like, how would you define a framework which the U.S. should compete with China?
Yeah, so this is what's hard. It's kind of like, what's effective at like rallying the troops versus what is actually going on. You know, as an expert, a lot of my views on China and how it's a threat and when is it a threat and under what conditions are like too nuanced for the average senator when they're like, Oriana, how do I just get the American people on board with this? And so I understand the like, well, China is evil because they're an autocracy is a very easy direction to go in, but it is inaccurate. And it's not just like, I'm not being an apologist, you know, for China, but it leads to all sorts of policy ideas that are incorrect. You know, when you think of things like China selling surveillance equipment or training police forces in other countries, the majority of countries are doing that with are democracies, right? So if we're, and the countries that they're closest to, they have a strategy, you know, the biggest problem is not like the Tajikistans of the world. The biggest problem is France, who's a democracy, who's a friend of the United States, that because of those economic ties, you know, tend to do China's bidding more than we would like. So it's not so much that it's like this split world, and China knows this, and that's why they don't believe in alliances. And I have a whole section of the book on this. It's because they're like, it would alienate the wrong countries, and the amount of extra power they would get by being closer, you know, to Iran is minimal. They want to be closer to the European Union, not to Iran. And then, you know, trying to win over the developing world. One of the problems is that Xi Jinping, the leader of China, has been very clear that he wants to China to be the leader of the developing world. They're diversifying markets away from allies and partners. And in a lot of those places, the Chinese are kind of right that the main concerns are about economic development more than they are about political system. And so if the United States, you know, is only willing to work with certain countries under certain conditions, we concede, you know, the battleground before the contest has even started. So trying to think about like what would be effective and less about what's just like an easy rule of thumb to understand things like, you know, people look at Ukraine, they ask me all the time, what does that mean? You know, what does China learn from Ukraine? And it's so strange because there's nothing similar about Ukraine or Taiwan. And I always ask, well, why doesn't anyone ask what the United States should learn from Russian failures? Do people assume the U.S. military is going to fail because the Russian military is failing? Why do they think that it has any bearing on how the Chinese military is going to perform? And that's because people think, oh, they're both autocracies, so they must basically be the same country. So that's why I often argue against that, is because I think it leads to poor strategy and poor policy decisions that make the United States less effective at competition.
So it's just a poor strategy from the U.S. perspective of thinking everything is more of a zero-sum game versus a positive-sum game?
Well, so that's a bit different than saying, is it autocracy versus democracy, right? I mean, I do think in the vast majority of cases, not all, you know, I had some work on North Korea contingencies, for example, in which I think mainly working with China is better than trying to deter Chinese intervention. But I would say at this point, it's a good 85% of issues are just that we have conflicting interests so that there's very little room for cooperation. But that's not the case across the board. That hasn't always been the case. But, you know, Xi Jinping has been pretty adamant about redefining and rethinking kind of China's role in the world and what they want. And that has made it difficult, I think, for us to think in a more positive way.
Yeah, there's a way, I guess, framing the conversation of it's always from a U.S. perspective, but actually understanding what the Chinese want from the world and kind of what their strategy is for kind of their own people. Sure. Where do you think, call it the next few years or even the 4 years of Trump administration, are the China relations going to improve with the U.S. or do you think they're going to start decaying over the next 4 years?
So it kind of depends. I think the Chinese are very concerned about a President Trump. And so they're basically going to try to do nothing over 4 years to like not provoke him. But at the same point, if President Trump does things that China feels like are aggressive towards China, they will disproportionately respond. And that, you know, depends on how the United States then responds about whether that leads to spirals. But I think generally speaking, the Chinese preference is like minimal engagement with the United States over the next 4 years. And that means that, you know, maybe they'll be a little bit less assertive than they would be otherwise, but they will respond and retaliate to, you know, offenses that they think the Trump administration executes against them. And so that balances it in the other direction. So if I had to place a bet, which trend would win out, I would say it's probably going to become tenser over the next 4 years.
I mean, yesterday there was a potential that President Trump would issue an executive order to reinstate TikTok. Do you think this was more of like a fig leaf to the Communist Party, or do you think this is more of a domestic issue that President Trump wanted to help towards a domestic audience?
Yeah, you know, it's hard for me to read the mindset of President Trump, but I think what the Chinese are going to take it as is a sign of the increased influence of individual business leaders in decision-making in U.S. policy more than it is, you know, any sort of olive branch to China. It's just that certain people in the United States benefit from certain commercial arrangements, and President Trump is going to honor those. So I think it probably is more domestic, and China sees it as more domestic.
I've heard you on previous podcasts talking about the TikTok as a national security threat. Do you think actually having TikTok banned in the United States is still a national security threat, or do you think some of these ideas have been assuaged over the last couple of years?
Now, it's a little bit outside of my area of expertise, but as far as I know, there's been no changes to China's like national security laws and data laws that make it so data is anyway protected from the Chinese Communist Party. And so given that, I think nothing has changed in terms of the profile of the threat of those types of platforms.
Perfect. So to wrap up our conversation, there is one action the U.S. could take to improve its strategic posture vis-a-vis China. What do you think it should be?
I mean, if I work on military issues, so this isn't to say this is the most important thing, but it's what is always on my mind, which is getting certain platforms, in particular bombers, submarines, and land-based anti-ship missiles, many, 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 many more of them within the first island chain of China, with many, many, many more ammunition stockpiled and ready to go. I think that is the number one guarantee that we have that the Chinese will behave themselves, is if they don't have other options. If they don't have good options to use military force in Asia, I think deterrence will hold. And the peace and stability the U.S. has created in the Indo-Pacific, over the past 75 years will continue.
Perfect. So, Dr. Mastro, thank you. This has been a fascinating discussion. And thank you for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us on Small World, Big Problems. We hope you found our discussion as fascinating and helpful as I did. If you're interested in more discussion on strategy and security topics, please subscribe to the show on whichever platform you get your podcasts. This episode was edited by Emma Ding, and this has been a production of the Johns Hopkins Vice Philip Merrill Center for Strategic Studies in Washington, D.C.